WILL AM 580, this February 13th, 2011. Today we have a great show, one much anticipated and much requested over the past year or so. We have the senior member of the Federal Communications Commission with us, Commissioner Michael J. Copps, joining us for the full hour live. Should be a wonderful show. We'll be taking your calls. But before we go to Commissioner Copps, let's first go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
With our TV screens and newspapers flooded with coverage of Hollywood starlets gone bad and murder and mayhem in the streets, you have to wonder about the really important stories that aren't being covered by the major news outlets. Project Censored helps answer that question with Censored 2011, a book chronicling the 25 top stories that corporate media ignored last year. The program, which started in 1976 at Sonoma State University in California, is now celebrating its 35th year and includes over 30 universities. Mickey Huff, an associate professor of history at Diablo Valley College, also in California, is the new director of the project. He says the project looks at important work pushed to the margins and shut out of the public conversation.
We consider what are these reporters or scientists or experts in these variety fields, what are they writing, what are they saying, and why is it not getting a fair hearing in the public arena?
Huff has found that despite media technology opening new channels of communication, propaganda and spin have become better at stifling competing ideas.
Censorship really is anything that interferes with the free flow of information in a society that purports to have a free press structure. So censorship isn't just the story that's never published. It's a story that doesn't get widespread distribution regardless of its factual nature.
Media manipulating filters, described by political scientist and historian Michael Parenti, show what modern censorship looks like, says Huff.
Labeling, follow-up avoidance and questioning, slighting contents, the employment of a variety of informal fallacies, whether they be red herring distractions, straw person distortions, ad hominem attacks. These are all things that act to distort the message and spin meaning and generate more of opinion-type journalism that we have today, where all opinions seem to get to masquerade equally, even if they lack factual merit.
The solution is for people to understand how corporate media are constructed and seek out independent news, becoming active participants in the media.
Most people do not have access to telecommunication technologies in ways that they can be the media so readily. But more and more, we're seeing that. More and more, the messages being tweeted, out of Egypt, more and more, the coverage that people have on phones and things that show the world a lot of what's going on, that's a really positive step because it's bypassing the power elite filters.
To read the top 25 censored stories of 2011, go to projectcensored.org.
During 1 week this coming April, families and kids are urged to turn off their computers, TVs, and video screens and turn on the world around them. During Screen Free Week, children are encouraged to swap passive playtime for more active, imaginative pursuits. The nonprofit organization Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood is spearheading the initiative. Susan Lin is co-founder and director of CCFC and a psychologist at Harvard Medical School. She says children and young people spend an excessive amount of time watching television and online media. On average, preschool children spend over 4.5 hours a day in front of TVs and computers, while older children spend over 7 hours a day.
For the first time in history, we can't assume that when children have leisure time that they are engaged in creative play or in active play. Instead, what we're finding around the world is that the number one activity is to be in front of a screen.
Lynn says that so much time in front of the TV can lead to some serious issues, from childhood obesity to attention disorders. Kids are less likely to even know how to play on their own or rely on their imaginations for entertainment.
We're raising a generation of children that is either bored or anxious if they're away from a screen. One thing that it's important to do for a satisfying, healthy, creative life is to be able to engage with the world and to actively explore the world around them with all of their senses. And entertainment screen media really prevents kids from doing it.
CCFC has resources for schools, families, and daycares that want to celebrate Screen Free Week with alternative activities like board games, baking, arts and crafts, reading, or simply allowing unstructured playtime.
It's really about using it as a springboard to make significant life changes and to reduce the presence of entertainment screen media in children's lives all year round.
Screen Free Week is April 18th through the 24th. To find out more and download a toolkit, visit commercialfreechildhood.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, WILL AM 580, this February 13th, 2011. It is our great privilege to have back as a guest yet again Michael J. Copps, the ranking member of the Federal Communications Commission, approaching his 10th anniversary on the FCC, here to join us for the full hour to talk about the panoply of issues facing the Federal Communications Commission. Commissioner Copps, welcome to Media Matters.
Well, thank you, Bob. It's always a pleasure to be with you, and I particularly appreciate your teeing up a global audience here. That's something I don't normally have, so thank you.
Well, it's really a pleasure, and I should alert our listeners that this week we're going to have the sound might be a little different than most weeks because I'm working off of a conventional phone for a variety of reasons. Next week we'll be back on the same technology you're familiar with and accustomed to here at WILL. And Commissioner Copps, let's start, first of all, because I know we have a lot of listeners who hear the term Federal Communications Commission, or FCC, and some of them might not even hear it that often. But they really don't know what exactly it is, what it does, how it's structured. Maybe just a little civics lesson at the top. What is the Federal Communications Commission? Who's on it? What do they do?
Well, the Federal Communications Commission is an independent regulatory body established by statute back in 1934. It's composed of five members who are nominated by the President of the United States and confirmed by the United States Senate. In a Democratic administration like we have now, there will be three Democrats and two Republicans, and when the party roles are reversed and the Republicans are in charge, it will be three Republicans and two Democrats. And we are charged by statute with overseeing communications by wire and radio, different degrees of involvement, whether you're talking about the broadcast, where we have some significant oversight responsibilities, cable and satellite, perhaps just a tad less. Also over the telecommunications infrastructure, and that includes both basic and advanced telecommunications, and I think that certainly incorporates broadband and the Internet, jurisdiction over international allocations of spectrum, working with other countries, satellite. We take the statutes that Congress gives us and turn them into rules and regulations, and then when complaints come our way or the need for clarification is there, we act and vote and decide the issues. We are not really, I don't think, usually a partisan commission. I would say that 90 to 95% of the decisions that are made by the FCC are done unanimously, and that when there is disagreement, usually that will go to a particular commissioner's interpretation of a statute itself, or maybe a differing interpretation of the factual circumstances surrounding a particular case. But at times, when you get into some of the issues, like I'm sure we'll talk about today, there seems to be a little more partisanship, maybe to be expected. But in any event, we have approximately a sixth of the economy under the one degree or another of oversight by the FCC, so it's important.
And if I may add on that point, Commissioner Copps, one aspect of the FCC that distinguishes it from, if I'm not mistaken, probably virtually any other branch of the federal government, any other administrative agency, is that it does not merely regulate already existing industries. The FCC grants the monopoly licenses that creates multi-billion dollar industries. I mean, you guys aren't just regulators, you're creators of industries like broadcasting and when you give out a satellite license, for example, for Spectrum to use satellite television, you know, not everyone can do it. There's only so many companies
right.
that can do it. So you create the winner by who you select.
Well, we do, and an important thing that I should have mentioned is we're responsible for holding spectrum auctions, which allocates the spectrum. So that does indeed have a large impact on the economy. And when we make a decision about what a telecommunications company can and cannot do, that has reverberations through the economy. When some faction of the commission argues that advanced telecommunications or broadband is not really under the purview of the commission, and they vote that way, if they have a majority, that certainly affects how that industry is going to roll out and the state of competition. And it works in the mirror image, too, of course, that way.
Now, we're going to go into specific details, as you've already alluded to, Commissioner Copps, with regard to the recent Comcast merger with NBC United, Universal, excuse me. But before we do, I mean, just a general term, because this issue has come up before. Given the amount of influence the FCC has on huge portions of the American economy, I mean, what's the percentage of, you know, who's at the FCC building there in Washington? What's the nature of the lobbying process that faces you as a member when a big issue comes up that affects powerful companies?
Okay, well, who's there is first of all our staff, mostly in Washington, but also in a few offices around the country, about just under 2,000, 1,900 strong telecom experts. So we have a good depth of understanding of the issues on their engineering and practical basis. But you raise certainly an important question of how does the FCC respond to all of the interests that are around town. And a lot of the interests around town are big and established telecom companies, the big telephone companies, the big cable companies, the big Internet companies, lots of lobbyists are deployed. You can talk about the Comcast merger and some of the others. These are examples of multimillion-dollar lobbying expenditures. My one of my crusades since I came there in 2001 is to reflect the fact that we're supposed to be a consumer protection agency, and we're supposed to reach out to all stakeholders, and every stakeholder and every citizen in this country is indeed a stakeholder in our telecommunications infrastructure. It's how we talk to one another outside of our personal conversations. It's how we talk to each other on the telephone or the radio or television, the Internet, what have you. So it's really our whole civic dialogue and our conversation with ourselves as a nation that's at stake here. So I want to reach out when we say we want to get advanced telecommunications out to everybody. We have to mean everybody. We don't just mean the affluent, but we mean poor. We don't just mean urban, but we mean rural. We don't just mean healthy and well, but the many disability communities in the country. We mean places like Indian Country, where Native Americans are still in a state of telecommunications evolution that is just shocking and embarrassing to us as a country. So we have to reach out and talk to these people and get their input. And I've tried to do that. I think the commission should do a lot more of its business out on the road. We ought to get the commission out of just meeting in Washington, D.C. every month and go to various parts of the country. And that way we learn more about what's going on, and the stakeholders who have the expertise, who can tell us about how is the radio or the TV or the telecommunications infrastructure working, we can hear directly from them. That, it just seems to me, is common good sense in the way that any good consumer protection agency should function. We don't always meet that, although I think we're doing better than we were a few years ago.
Well, I think there's no question the FCC is more active in that regard than a few years ago. If I'm not mistaken, and I don't know the exact figures, but prior to your coming to the Federal Communications Commission in 2001, Commissioner Copps, to my knowledge, there were virtually no general public hearings for the general public held outside of the Washington, D.C. area to take up sort of crucial issues to get public input going back many, many decades. And since you've been there, I know there have been at least 5, 10, 15 formal public hearings of the FCC as the commissioners have traveled around, but at least that many, if not more, informal ones, and you've pretty much attended every single one all over the country.
Well, we tried, and we were doing the media ownership issues under Chairman Powell and Chairman Martin. My colleague Jonathan Alstein and I decided we couldn't get permission from the chairman then to do as many public hearings around the country as we wanted, so we went off and did some on our own. But basically, whenever a congressperson would ask us or express an interest in coming to a town hall meeting or some kind of a forum back home, we would try to go there, and I suspect between the two of us, we probably did, gosh, I don't know, 60, 70, maybe more of those kinds of meetings held by, Free Press and lots of other advocacy and consumer groups, too, and some held by congresspeople and various civic groups in towns and cities throughout the country.
What do you think you learned from all these public hearings, Commissioner Copps, that you've done over the last decade that had you just stayed in Washington, as most commissioners have done historically and many of your colleagues do to this present day, and restrict your diet to Washington insiders, to, frankly, almost overwhelmingly commercial lobbyists who might appear at your office. How has your understanding of the issues changed by meeting so many people all across the country in the public and talking about these issues?
You find out that people know a lot more about this stuff than you think, and you learn a lot about what their practical experiences are, and I never have come away from any meeting anywhere where I wasn't better informed than when I left. And, you know, when we did the initial media ownership debate back in 2002 and 2003, we went all around this country with hearings, and I think there was a feeling at the commission amongst a majority at that time that these were kind of arcane issues and people really didn't care too much about how many broadcast outlets one company held or owned. And lo and behold, by the time we got into the summer of 2003, 3 million people, that's 3 million citizens, had contacted the FCC and Congress saying, "We don't like the idea of loosening ownership limits. We don't like the idea of a few companies gobbling up our local independent broadcast stations." There's a feel, and it's palpable when you go out to these hearings. People understand that something is wrong. They understand that newsrooms have been decimated. They understand that investigative journalism is on the endangered species list. And they understand that they need information to be well-informed and productive participants in our democracy. And that came through, and, you know, that's why I'm so strong in urging, let's go out on the road some more, let's do more hearings, and let's find every possible way we can to solicit input from all stakeholders, and that's potentially all citizens.
I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580. We're coming to you live today, February 13th, 2011. Our guest, who you've just been listening to, is Federal Communications Commissioner Michael J. Copps, longest-standing member of the FCC, approaching your 10th anniversary. Congratulations, Commissioner.
Thank you very much.
And when does your current term end, Commissioner Copps?
My actual term, and this gets a little arcane, I guess, but my actual term has expired, and you can stay until somebody else is selected to fill that position until the end of the next session of Congress. So at the end of 2011, a determination will be made. But I will be speaking up and loudly about these issues, no matter where I am or what position I have. I think they're that important, and I have bound and determined, and said many times, I'm not going to hang up my hat from speaking out on these issues until we actually get some public interest obligations and responsibilities into this modern media system of ours that better reflects what we're supposed to be doing and what our media is supposed to be providing to the American people.
Well, I want to get down right now and start talking about some of the huge issues before the FCC and get more concrete. And if people would like to call in and join us, the number here at Media Matters, if you want to talk with Commissioner Michael Copps, is 217-333-3811. 1-800-222-9455, and our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. The lines are open. Commissioner, there are two great issues that have dominated the news regarding communication since December, and the FCC has been in the middle of both of them. One is network neutrality, and the second is the Comcast-NBC merger. Let's start with network neutrality. And if I can, Commissioner Cuffs, again, there might be some listeners not really familiar with what exactly this means and what exactly the FCC has to do with it and what they did. Can you give a little bit of a civics lesson and then tell us what happened in December?
Well, I think network neutrality, which I think is a god-awful term, and I think we should start out by calling it Internet freedom or the open Internet, basically means to me that consumers going online should be able to access the legal content of their choice. They should be able to run the applications of their choice, attach devices of their choice, enjoy the benefits of some competition. There should be openness and transparency in how the system is run. And there should be some strong principles of non-discrimination so that everybody can partake equally here. If the Internet is going to be our really town square of democracy, and our town square of democracy is going to be paved with broadband bricks, we have to make sure that every citizen has access to that. So I think when we talk about all this, we can get into the weeds real quick, but I think you've got to fly 30,000 feet first and say to my belief is that the freedom to access Internet websites of our choosing and our freedom to access one another is a defining freedom, really, of the 21st century. And freedom of expression online is no less important than freedom of expression in a town square or from a podium.
Who could possibly oppose that, Commissioner Cox? Put that way, I mean, that seems, you serve that up with the apple pie, don't you?
Well, you know, if you look at the history of just about every communications development we've had in this country over the past century, there's always, and there's a certain dynamic, I think, of going from openness and freedom to trying those who run the system to control the distribution, control the content. I think you can look at the history from radio and film and television and cable, and each one of these was hailed as a new era of openness and freedom that was going to change things for the better in our country, and they all came under increasing consolidation and control by the few, thanks to the dynamics of the marketplace and thanks to a regulatory commission probably too heavily influenced by some of those lobbying groups that we talked about earlier. So we got a new administration in 2008 that had run on a record of being in favor of Internet freedom and the open Internet, and Chairman Jenikowski, likewise, who opened a process whereby we could tackle this subject and try to develop some rules of the road to keep that network open, particularly the on-ramps to the Internet, so that there are no gatekeepers, there are no toll booth operators, you're not discriminated against, and if there are glitches and somebody finds their service not what they should be, that there's a venue to complain about that and do something about it. And so that process has been ongoing, and in December, some rules were passed in that regard, particularly with regard to openness on the wire line part of the equation. I concurred in that decision. This gets a little inside the Beltway, too, but concur means you're for the outcome, but you don't necessarily agree with the way they got there or all the details. So while I supported some of the rules, I was distressed that wireless was not treated more on a parity with wireline. Some will say, well, wireless is just such a nascent, young technology, so you shouldn't have any oversight just let it go for a few years and then come back and revisit it. And my fear, justified by a history of the other media industries I talked about, is that if you let it go for a few years, you'll never get it under control. While it's a fast developing and impressive technology, it's 4G is not that nascent or unpredictable a development. Most people are, more and more people are cutting their wireline and going to wireless. More and more people are going to experience their internet on wireless. So how can we just say the public interest aspects of that aren't as important as the public interest aspects of an open internet on the wireline? Now, there were some other differences I had with prioritized paid prioritization and specialized services and all that. I don't want to get too detailed about it.
Yeah,
but we took a half a step, but we didn't, maybe more than half a step, but we didn't go all the way.
You know, I think for the sake of our listeners, let's go back to 30,000 feet, because I think right now we still don't have a protagonist here. Who exactly doesn't want net neutrality? I mean, why is this an issue?
Well, I think you look first at, again, as I was trying to say, at those who run the system and manage the system. There's always a dynamic in our system to exert control, and there's always the fear on people like me that as you combine the ability to control distribution and content, you create a monopoly or a duopoly, and we don't have a heck of a lot of competition in our telecommunications. Most people, when it comes to broadband, have at best the duopolistic choice, a choice of two very powerful providers, the telephone company and the cable company. It's not a rich diversity of providers in which competition can really flourish. And competition is obviously of benefit to consumers. So we haven't been going in sufficiently strong direction in competition.
Let me rephrase that, and I'll make it a true-false question. Is it fair enough to say, for the sake of listeners who still don't quite get it, that the phone and cable giants, Comcast, Verizon, and AT&T, would greatly benefit without net neutrality because then they could have control over the system, and that therefore they have lobbied intensively to either not have it or to water it down?
I think it's fair to say that large companies have the incentive to do exactly that, and it doesn't impose evil designs on their intentions or anything like that. There's just that dynamic to exercise that control, and it's something in our country that we always need to be alert about. I think, frankly, and you and I would probably agree on this, that special interests exert far too much sway in the decisions that are made in Washington, D.C. And elsewhere. Our country has always had to struggle against that, and we have periods of in our history where people will rise up to the occasion and do something about it, and periods when they don't. And my hope is that we are in a period now when people will demand that kind of change and demand more competition in the telecommunication services of the future. And this architecture of the internet is so open, so dynamic, so opportunity creating. It affects just about every aspect of our lives, and probably the greatest, most enabling technology development since the printing press. How we can even contemplate allowing the kind of consolidation and control to take place there that has occurred elsewhere is really something that I find almost mind-boggling.
Our guest you've just been listening to is FCC Commissioner Michael J. Kopp, joining us live on the phone today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. If you'd like to call in with the phone call, the lines are open at 217-333-9455. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455. We have a couple callers in waiting patiently. Let's go to the phones right now. Line 1, Chicago, you're on the air with Michael Kopp.
Hi, Commissioner Kopp.
Good afternoon.
Hi, how are you? I know you've historically been very supportive of public access channels, and you're well aware that, you know, jobs, health information, public safety, this is the place those things are happening. But where AT&T's put in its U-verse system in the suburbs and in the Chicago area, you can find a pay-per-view porno channel a lot easier than you can find these public channels. And I know you're also very aware that there's been a petition sitting at the SEC for over 2 years on this to stop that kind of discrimination against the public. And, you know, we had high hopes for this SEC. We were looking to have this kind of thing stopped. So I'd really appreciate you commenting on what the holdup is and when the SEC is going to act on this.
Thank you very much, caller. And Commissioner Copps, for the sake of listeners who might not be familiar with the public access channels or what are sometimes called the PEG channels, can you just give a little background on what this is all about?
Well, the public educational and governmental channels are a provision that's provided by statute so that a certain amount of broadcast spectrum will be reserved for the non-commercial, citizens-oriented, locally-oriented type of broadcasting that really puts people in touch with their community. And you're absolutely right. This is something where a decision has to be made, where we need to be proactive. The commission has been, and I understand this fully, extremely busy the last couple of years teeing up a broadband plan and a broadband strategy for the United States of America, dealing with network neutrality, dealing with Comcast, and I'll grant them all of that. But I think when it comes to matters of the media, that we don't have a passing grade at this particular point. And all of these issues that I've been talking about since 2001 are crying out for action, and community access broadcasting is one of those things. There's no reason why you should have to really why you should have to be Sherlock Holmes to find out where your PEG channel is located on the spectrum, or you have to go way up to the channel 900 on cable or something like that, and then get into some kind of drop down box and then fight for how to locate it there when everything else is so easy to locate. So I'm with you. I think these petitions need to be addressed, and I think across the whole panoply of things that matter, media matters, as the previous show has it, we need to get busy.
Okay, let's go back to the phone lines right now. Let's now go to line 2, Champaign County. You're on the air with Commissioner Michael J. Copps.
Yeah, good afternoon, gentlemen. Without getting in too much in the weeds about common carrier and all that, but it just seems that the latest ruling that sort of takes net neutrality away from the wireless part of the spectrum. Now, the wireless part of the spectrum has always been thought of as the more specifically public airwaves, and maybe there's plenty of room now, but the proliferation of devices is going to be such that that's a lot of territory to cede. So have you just thought about it in that way, and what the high irony of that? It just seems
An irony, but I think all of these modes of communication have public interest dimensions attached to them. And you know, the problem here that the earlier commissions got us into, I think we had our marching orders in the telecommunications statute of 1996 to do our best to make sure that advanced telecommunications were built out, wireline, wireless, plain old telephone service, the POTS, what I call the PANs, the pretty awesome new stuff, too. We need both the POTS and the PANs to get built out, but we had two commissions from 2001 and 2009 that said, wait just a minute. We're not going to call this broadband and this internet telecommunications at all. We're going to take it out of that part of the law where traditionally telecommunications, telephone service have been overseen and regulated by the FCC, where generations of activists and advocates had made sure there were privacy protections and homeland security and provisions for universal service so you could build that out. The previous majority said, no, we'll call it something else. We're going to call this an information service, and we're going to put it into a really ambiguous part of the statute where it doesn't belong, and that's what they did. And the court then finally, when the abuses became so obvious and the previous commission decided to take Comcast to court, the court said you can't correct that under the new designation that you've given this stuff. So, you know, if that wasn't symbolic of the mistake that they originally made by this reclassification, we have got to put all of this stuff squarely back where it belongs, which is under so-called Title II of the Telecommunications Act, where privacy, all those other things that I just mentioned, consumer benefits, public safety and all, can be overseen by the commission and make sure that the broadband information infrastructure of the future is overseen with the people in mind, just like plain old telephone service was.
Now, Commissioner Copps, to follow up on that, as I understand it, the FCC, as you pointed out, by reclassifying the Internet from, or broadband especially, from telecommunications to an information service, that sort of tied its own shoelaces in its ability to do what it's supposed to do. But as I understand it, it's really the FCC could just untie its shoelaces anytime it wanted to. I mean, you could just have a vote tomorrow and go back to how it was supposed to be, and then
all these
problems would be over.
I think that is exactly true, and those who oppose that can't really show me any court decision that that gets in the way of that. The commission is entitled to some deference from the courts, considerable deference, when it comes to decisions like this, and there are new circumstances or changes in the environment to adjust to it. And yes, we could vote tomorrow morning. And I wish we would. I'd be very much for this, to reclassify this stuff as Title II and get it done and avoid all of this long debate that we've been having for the last couple of years.
Have you had this conversation with any other members of the SEC? Are they familiar with this even, that this is something
oh, yeah.
they could do?
They are 100% familiar with this.
And but they're 0% interested in having this vote at some
point. No, I wouldn't say that, but I think the decision has been made to try to go down the Title I route, which is that more ambiguous part of the statute, and try to find some better justifications than the commission had when it went to court in the Comcast case. And I think to some extent they have, but it's just so tentative. And every time we make a decision and have to find some new Title I justification, you're going to run the same risk of being turned back by the court. Why not just go back to where all the anti-discrimination obligations were and put it in Title II and treat telecommunications as telecommunications? Doesn't make any difference in my mind if they're basic telecommunications or advanced telecommunications. It's how the people communicate with one another. And that's under Title II, and that's where we ought to be planting our flag and getting this debate over and done with so we can get on with the rest of the people's business.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines now. Again, our guest today on Media Matters, you've just been listening to, is Commissioner Michael J. Copps of the Federal Communications Commission. The number here at Media Matters is 217-333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. The lines are open. Let's go to our toll-free line right now. Line 4, New York City, you're on the air with Commissioner Copps.
Hi, thanks for having me. I wanted to go back to something, Bob, you were talking about earlier, that the FCC grants these licenses, and these are obviously very valuable and they create business. And from time to time, the FCC makes rulings that can affect business. So if you remember back in 1969-70, you know, from heavy pressure from the FCC, tobacco advertising was taken off of television. And obviously, you know, it hurt the business of tobacco to some degree, but it was considered not for the public good to have those ads on television. As the sort of flip side of that, we've obviously seen the rise of direct-to-consumer pharmaceutical advertising, and this is obviously, you know, some would argue has been to the detriment of the public good, and that we've seen an increase in, you know, the use of drugs and, you know, deaths, et cetera, associated with those drugs. So the business that I actually want to talk about, and I'm interested whether the FCC from its side could really kind of make an end run on this, and it's the business of actually campaign election finance. And, you know, the reason why it costs so much money ultimately to get elected and to run a campaign is because of the cost of the television ads. And if the FCC is the one that holds the license, can't the FCC essentially say all political ads should just be free? It's a public good, and now, you know, no politicians need to raise any more money. And it would be hard to imagine even a politician, you know, not supporting that or getting behind it. And I know that the broadcast lobby, which is hugely influential, you know, would oppose that, but in essence, any politician that could pass it would be free of that. So I'm just curious as to whether, you know, I know Lawrence Lessig is working very hard on this issue, and with the rise of Citizens United and what that's going to do, couldn't we ultimately just approach it from an FCC perspective? And that's what I'd like you to comment on. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And I must say, Commissioner Copps, that wasn't a planted question, but as you know, that is an issue near and dear to my heart, too. So can the FCC, does it have a statutory right to do something to address this, you know, enormous increase in TV political advertising combined with enormous decrease in TV political campaign journalism?
Well, first of all, you put yourself, you put us into exactly where we should be in a discussion on the influence of money in this town and in our political process. And certainly it is that we need to do something about it. Of the $3 or $4 billion that were spent in the congressional campaigns last year, I think a huge part of that, approaching $3 billion, went to paid media. I have been advocating for a number of months now one way to tee up this problem. You know, we, you and I and every other citizen in this country was bombarded with so much advertising during the campaign, which came to you from the Citizens for a More Beautiful America or some lofty-sounding phrase, and it doesn't give you a clue of who is behind the Citizens for a More Beautiful America or whatever the group is. I think the commission has the authority, and I've asked it to look into this and give me their reasoned analysis. But I, from what I can see, we will have the authority to say we're going to demand some further disclosure on this. People have a right to know when they're seeing these ads for a greener environment. You know, is that really a green ad or isn't it a green ad or is some other group behind it? And it's gotten completely unknowable in the environment that we are in right now. Nobody has a clue, and the Citizens United decision, I think, has just opened the floodgates to the use of money in politics to the point where used to be a historian that spent a lot of time studying the Gilded Age. There's an awful lot of similarity between Gilded Age when it comes to our politics 100 years ago and the new one that we're in right now, and we need to find a way to A, limit the role of money, and B, if we can't limit it, at least to make it transparent to everybody who's paying for what, so we know who is really influencing the outcome of elections in this country.
Commissioner Copps, here's a wild and crazy question, the sort of one that comes after one's been on a bar stool for a while, but since it's my show, I can ask it, and I'm not at a bar stool, I should also add.
But, you know,
does the FCC have the legal or statutory power to say to broadcast licensees, if you run paid political advertisement for candidates, you have to allow equal time for free to everyone else on the ballot immediately after the ad. So while someone can buy an ad, they can't, you know, buy a monopoly of our attention because they have more money. Everyone else gets to run an ad, too, for free. Do you have the legal right to do something like that?
I would just, being perfectly frank, don't see a way of doing that without without the Congress and some guidance and change coming from there in order to be able to do this.
No, I agree. I think it's insane, but I mean, I think that's the sort of solution people are looking for after these campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines now. Our guest again, Commissioner Michael Copps from the Federal Communications Commission, graciously joining us for the full hour today on Media Matters. The phone lines here again, 217-333-9455, or our toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to line two now. Chicago, you're on the air with Commissioner Michael J. Copps.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner, for finding the opportunity for regular folks to offer questions to you. We don't often get that opportunity. One concern that I have, I work with city and county government, is the role of the FCC with regard to broadband and barriers to entry. Last week there was a workshop that the FCC held regarding the growth of broadband and elimination of barriers to entry. One concern that we have is that local governments, cities and counties, will wind up being under further scrutiny by the FCC for their decisions where it's not necessarily automatic that a broadband system can be buried in the right-of-way in an expeditious manner due to various issues, or that a cell tower can't go up as fast as a cell company would like because of various zoning issues. Do you see an expanding role of the FCC with regard to more intrusion or enhanced oversight of municipal decisions concerning broadband expansion?
Well, absolutely, I do. These are sometimes difficult questions. I have always been an advocate of close cooperation in our federal system between the central government and the state and municipal governments, and I think previous commissions have been probably too quick to preempt local and municipal rights, and there is that tendency when powerful political forces are pushing something where things can come out the wrong way. Now, I think to be perfectly fair about it, when you're talking about getting broadband infrastructure deployed, I think there's a time urgency for that. I think you can point to some examples where some municipalities have sat on these things too long. I don't think it's as widespread as some people say. We've gotten into this debate on several specific issues, and I always say, let me see the record of the intransigence of the municipalities and the states. And it's always a good bit thinner than I was led to believe at the beginning. But I think you can't allow, you know, putting up a tower to be delayed for months or years. I don't think that happens too much, but I think it does happen sometimes. But that's a fundamental principle of our system of government, though, that the citizens of the municipality and the locality who live there and are going to be impacted by the cell tower, or the folks in Indian country who don't want a cell tower put up on their sacred ground, those folks have a right to be listened to and heard before we act. So it's really a question of some balance and looking at each one of those on a individual basis without just signing up 100% on one side or the other. But your point is well taken, and it's one that I have been concerned with during the time I've been at the FCC.
Commissioner Copps, we have one final caller, but before we get to the call, I want you to have a chance to talk about the Comcast-NBC Universal merger, which you opposed, which was approved about 3 weeks ago. And, you know, explain why this is an issue that I think you have been outspoken in your concern about and what it portends for the future.
Well, you're right. We approved that. I was a 5-1 vote. I was the commissioner who voted against it, and I did so for a number of reasons. First of all, this was an unprecedented merger. It involved not only traditional media, television and cable, but it involves all the new media coming down the road. And again, remember, we're trying to keep that open and the open internet and all of that, rather than see it cableized, for want of a better term. We want to avoid the cablization of the internet. So it combined all of that with so many implications. And I know that the folks who put the agreement together and the Comcast lawyers and all, they know everything that they'd be allowed to do under the terms of that agreement, but we need to make sure that we know, too. This is also, second reason, kind of an unprecedented in media industry combination of control over content and control over distribution. This is cable TV, it's content production, it's cable systems and distribution. So that's always the key to monopolization or whatever. So I thought it was potentially hugely dangerous to the future.
Well, let me. I know that we could do a whole hour on this show, and I'm sorry we have no more time, but I do want to get to callers. So this is one final point on this that I think is important. Now that Comcast, the largest broadband wire, you know, cable company by far in the country, is merging with a film studio and cable and TV network, how can the FTC or FCC or Department of Justice or anyone oppose Google merging with Verizon or AT&T with Disney when they can say, hey, look, we've got to be able now to compete with Comcast and NBC?
Well, you know, that's always the refrain I hear when companies will come in and say, this is going to be the last big merger ever. Just let us get a little bit bigger and all will be well. And my reply always to them is, yeah, you can say that. But, you know, as soon as your mergers improve, somebody else is going to be here asking for the same thing. The big always want to get bigger. And I think there's going to be lots more mergers, lots more consolidation. And consolidation has been highly destructive to our telecommunications infrastructure and to the citizens of the country, and we've got to avoid it, and we went down the wrong road with Comcast.
Well, Michael Copps is our guest, the FCC commissioner. We have two callers waiting patiently. I'm going to ask them to make their calls as brief as possible so we can get to both of them. Let's start with line one, Champaign. You're on the air.
Hi, Michael. I'm a retiree on essentially a Social Security income. I don't even subscribe to cable TV because it's too expensive, but I absolutely have to have broadband. And I did some really good research. At my address in Champaign, I cannot get DSL. They have a really good metropolitan area network called WOLO here that is very reasonable and very nice, but I can't get a line of sight to their tower. So I am stuck with the local cable company, who I won't mention, but their initials are Comcast. And if you go through all their packages and bundles and all that to get basic non-economy, in other words, fast enough to actually see video, their costs are up around $50 or $60 just for broadband. They have all kinds of packages and all that, but I can't afford $50 or $60. So what I'm in is a micro-monopoly. I have no choice but to deal with our dear friends, Comcast. Can I get your reaction on micro-monopolies like that?
You know, and Commissioner Copps, I want to add to that wonderful call. The research I've seen recently shows that this is not uncommon at all, that a high percentage of Americans actually only have one legitimate option for broadband. And it's decreasing because the phone companies are increasingly jumping ship on broadband. You give wire broadband. They're letting the cable guys have it. And they're going to go monopolize the wireless world, Verizon and AT&T. And so we have these super monopolies now, and prices are through the roof compared to other countries, especially compared to what we're getting. What can we do about this?
Well, you know, your response to the caller is the same as mine. You are not alone. This is so common throughout the United States. That's what happens because we went down a non-competitive road. We didn't take the telecommunications statute of 1996 with its injunction to foster competitiveness seriously. It's sort of the act that never really got implemented in many respects. So we've got to look anew. We've got to realize we're, you know, 15th or 20th when it comes to broadband penetration in the United States. I saw the other day that Russia, which is not known for really, I think, pioneering telecommunications, is about to pass us or has passed us on getting fiber out to its citizens. We invented this stuff here in the United States. We developed it here. The innovation and the entrepreneurship is here. But yet for lack of competition, for a lack of regulatory oversight, for letting it fall under the mania that infected so much of the American economy during the super bubbles that led to the recent recession, we've gotten off the track and into the ditch. My old boss, Senator Hollings, used to say, when you got a real problem, he said, the ox is in the ditch. Well, our broadband ox is in the ditch, and we better find a way to pull it out.
Our guest today, Commissioner Michael Copps, we have time for one final caller. Let's go to line four, Peoria, Illinois. You're on the air with FCC member Michael Copps.
Yes, in fact, my question is related very much to the previous caller, and that is, just as you mentioned, the quality and cost around the world oftentimes are much better in the U.S. It just seems like it's appropriate time now that we really need to have an initiative that really addresses that whole issue.
You're right. You know, interesting experience. My wife and I took a vacation last fall to China, and we were sailing down the Yangtze River, which is not very wide, and mountains on each side. And every time I pulled out my my BlackBerry to get into the network and to check what was going on back home. I had a 3G service almost immediately, with one or two exceptions that maybe lasted 1 or 2 minutes. There are so many places in the United States of America that don't even have that 3G, let alone, of course, 4G, which is just starting to come down the pike. This is the opportunity-enabling stuff for the 21st century. This is how our kids are going to learn, how we're going to increasingly take care of ourselves, how we're going to conduct our civic dialogue, how we're going to relate to one another. And if we don't have it open and available to all and at a reasonable and competitive price and competition in the industry, America is really shooting itself in the foot.
Well, Commissioner Copps, we've only got about a minute or two left, and I guess I'd like to give you an opportunity now. If there's something coming down the pike at the SEC we haven't talked about, you think of particular interest to our listeners and to the American people, this is a chance. I'd love to hear what you think it is.
What I am always interested in, and what I have devoted so much of my time to, is the woeful state of our media. We've made a mess of it, and as a result, news, I think, has been put on the starvation diet. We've had 30 years of over-consolidation and letting a few companies control too much. The first thing they do to show that they're really good companies is or effective to Wall Street, good companies for Wall Street, is fire reporters, close newsrooms. And we've come pretty close, I think, to denying our citizens the depth and breadth of information they need to make decisions intelligent for the future of the country. We have got to find a way to reinstill the public interest in the broadcasters. That's why I have been so strong on let's have some kind of responsibility on license renewal for broadcast stations. Right now, all they have to do is send in a postcard every 8 years, and boom, boom, they get their license. It used to be every 3 years they had to come to the FCC, and the FCC had to take some positive action in saying, this station's doing a good job, it's serving the public interest, we will grant its license renewal. We have to get back to that kind of a framework, because otherwise this telecommunications infrastructure upon which we depend is just going to go down the same road of earlier media and deny the people the power and opportunity that they are really entitled to have through the transformative power of this technology.
Commissioner Michael J. Copps, I want to thank you so much for taking an hour out of your Sunday to join us here at Media Matters.
It's a pleasure to do so. I appreciate all of your listeners taking an hour out of their time to listen to me. And I want to thank you, Bob, for this show and all the good work that you do. And I look forward to all of us working together in the months ahead to try to make a difference in all of these issues, which are so important to all of us.
Well, thank you again, Commissioner. And I want to thank Kyle Croha, the engineer, and Melissa Trentz, my fantastic producer, for their great work today. I'm Bob McChesney. We'll be back in 167 hours with another episode of Media Matters.